Everybody,
This is Kim.
This is Kel. You're listening to Shiny Things.
What's shaking, bacon?
Oh, you know, same shit, different flies.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So, yeah, just same old, same old, you know.
It's February, March, and you know what, Kel? It's just the time where everybody starts to feel a little depressed and just, I'm not going to lie, I've been a little bit crabby.
Me too. And then, you know, with all the stuff going on in the world.
I know, that's so sad, and I don't really want to talk about it, but.
I don't either. I just want to be able to give Russia a spanking. And
they need a good hard kick in the ass.
Right, and then say, go sit in the corner.
They really do.
But that's not going to happen.
You know what they have? They have themselves another Hitler on their hands.
Yes. He's very similar. I think he just a nut. I think he needs a psych eval.
Yeah, I think so too. But I don't want to give him a lot of airtime. I just wanted to say to ask everybody to say a little prayer for the Ukrainian people.
Yep. And they have a kick ass president, man.
Oh, they sure do. Wish he would come over here.
I know.
He's not hard to look at either.
He is not. And he likes animals, so that's another plus. Well, today we're kind of talking about another hard ass. Not quite Hitler-like, but he was a bad dude. So today I'm going to tell you the story about Richard Kuklinski.
That name from?
He was known as the Iceman.
Oh, yes. Okay. I can't wait for this one.
Yes. So he was big in the mob, the Gambino family particularly.
Okay. He was a hitman, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I love this story.
It's pretty juicy. So, and I went back to like his childhood and then how they actually caught him. And trigger warning, here's some pretty like effed up stuff that he did.
Okay, so if you guys have a sensitive stomach or something, maybe it's not the podcast for you.
Right, because I'm going to quote a lot of the stuff he said to the cops.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah, he was just like matter of fact. So our tale begins in New Jersey Projects in April of 1935 with a Polish immigrant and his wife, who was an Irish immigrant. Stanislaw and Anna Kuklinski had Richard. He was the second of four children. As per most of these stories, Stanley was an abusive alcoholic that would regularly beat the shit out of his kids and his wife. In 1940, Stanley ended up beating one of Richard's older brothers, Florian, to death.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So when they brought him to the hospital, he fell down the stairs. But, you know, so Stanley wasn't the only aggressor because Kuklinski's mom meant business too. Like, those kids, like, she would beat the crap out of them. Like, one time he said that she tried to kill him with a kitchen knife during one of his beatings. Stanley eventually left the family, dropping in from time to time just to beat them up a bit and then drift away again.
Nice. So they were the kind of parents that ruled with an iron fist.
Right. Yeah, they were like legit immigrants. Like, no, this is how you're going to behave. Which, you know, good for them, but they shouldn't beat their kid to death. Or, you know, they could have taken it down way few notches. But by 10, like, Kuklinski was just pissed off. I mean, he was starting to act out. He started torturing animals. And it was really only a matter of time before he actually had killed his first victim, which would be only at the age of 13.
Wow.
But one of his other brothers, this one's name was Joseph, he was convicted of raping a 12-year-old girl and then throwing her and her pet dog off of the top of a 5-story building to their death.
So these kids had a lot of rage.
Yep. And when Kuklinski was asked in a jailhouse interview, he simply said, "We come from the same father. What is there to tell?" Wow. So, I mean, they're pretty hardcore.
Well, it's you know, it's like violence breeds violence.
Right.
They couldn't break the cycle, apparently.
But at least, I mean, I shouldn't condone. I'm not condoning it, but, you know, at least he wasn't out just, like, beating up everybody and every, you know, and torturing cats and things like that. Because he started quickly onto humans. So in 48, when he was 13, he started his life as a gang leader to the gang known as the Project Boys. And they were just this little small town piddly group. So the gang boys had bullied him for a bit of time before he took action. So, like, he wasn't originally the gang leader. He became the gang leader because he took a steel clothing rod from a closet, knowing that this kid was a local bully and that he was an asshole and he was always being mean to him. So Kuklinski says, I unintentionally beat Charlie Lane to death. With the steel rod from your closet.
Okay.
And then he dumped the body off the bridge at South Jersey. So he announced that he dumped Lane's body off the bridge after he had removed all of his teeth and chopped off all of his fingers with a hatchet.
Holy shit.
He's 13.
Wow, that's a lot of rage.
Yeah, but really smart when you think about it. And that was in 48. So there wasn't all of this DNA and stuff like that.
It was easier to get away with murder.
Right. They actually never recovered the kid's body. So after beating the life out of Lane, he went on to take the metal pole and beat the remaining gang members. That day, he had learned it was better to give than to receive, and he couldn't stand loud-mouthed people. So he became who he is today.
Wow, okay.
Or was. So in his adult life, he went on to marry Barbara Pedrici. They had three kids, and I mean, Kuklinski was a big dude. He weighed over 300 pounds, and he stood at least 6'4".
You know who he reminded me of? Tony Soprano.
Exactly. That, yeah. When you actually watch, like, some of the HBO documentaries, that's who he looks like.
Yeah.
So, and he would... Hold on. He would terrorize his family like his father had done. There's claims that he would beat Barbara and the kids, but then there's other people that say that, you know, they actually had a really good family life and that he left his work life at the door. So there were varying stories about that kind of stuff, and I'll tell you a fun Christmas Eve story that he told on one of his things. But he earned a great deal of money by running an illicit pornography movies trafficking. So what he would do is he would illegally produce these videos and he would basically go around and collect his debts using brute force. So breaking kneecaps. So during this time, he had written a bad check and had gotten arrested. But this was really his only crime that he had ever been arrested for before he was charged with murder. So, I mean, here you got this big dude and he's trying to make money and all this kind of stuff. And then he soon befriends Roy DeMeo, who was a member of the Gambino family. So some of his early assignments were like robberies and then pirating the pornos so that the mob could start selling them. The family quickly found that they could use his talent for murder. So they actually put him to the test. So his first test of loyalty was that him and DeMeo, they went out, they parked the car, and DeMeo pointed to a random guy who was just out walking his dog and told Kuklinski to go kill him. Without batting an eye, Kuklinski gets out of the car and walks past the guy, just like you're passing somebody in the street. Then he swings around and shoots the guy in the back of the head. From that day on, he was DeMeo's enforcer. Hmm. Like, that's no joke.
Apparently he doesn't have a conscience.
No, and that's... So that's the thing that pisses me off, because, you know, it's kind of like the Dexter mentality thing where, you know, Dexter took out bad guys.
Right.
And, you know, I'm sure that the crime family had bad guys that needed to be taken out. Why did they have to do this to this poor guy just exactly. walking his dog?
Perfectly innocent person had to pay the price, sort of like a game. If you kill him, you pass.
Right. And, you know, and he did. So, I mean, eventually, so how he got caught was, long story short, is he got sloppy. He started making mistakes, but they would actually make an undercover operation in 1985. So this is decades later. And this task force included the New Jersey Attorney General's Office and the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau. And they called it Operation Iceman. And we'll get into why they called him that later. So it was formed after a police officer was told by an informant that Kuklinski was connected to a gang that would carry out burglaries in Jersey. So as the burglaries continued, they had 5 unsolved homicides that ultimately had links to Kuklinski. He ended up being the last person to see these men before they were found dead. It's not good to be the last person to have seen all these people. So the people in question was a guy, his last name was Hoffa. Do you remember the drug, or I'm not, Hoffman, sorry.
Oh, okay. Something about Jimmy Hoffa.
We'll get into that later. Ooh. But Hoffman. So do you remember the drug Tagamet?
Yes, I do.
So for those of you who don't know, it's like Pepsid and all those other like acid reducing drugs that we have today. It was one of the first ones on the market. On April 29th, 1982, Paul Hoffman was lured into a warehouse where he thought he was going to be buying Tagamet off of Kuklinski. Hoffman showed up to a garage. So let me pause and set up this thing. So Kuklinski's told this guy, I'm going to sell you these drugs. It's X amount of money, blah, 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 blah. Kuklinski like rents a garage to make it seem like a legitimate thing. So he doesn't just like call him behind a dumpster somewhere. Like he rents an actual garage to set up this sting kind of thing. So Hoffman shows up and Kuklinski went to shoot him. Well, the gun jammed and he resorted to beating the shit out of Hoffman with a tire iron.
Snap.
Yeah. And then he put it, he likes 55 gallon drums. So he actually put the body in one of those drums and left it outside of a little hotel in New Jersey. And he would go in, this hotel was next to a diner. And he would go into the diner and he'd notice the thing still sitting out there and just kind of kept watching it and kept watching it, kept watching it. And then one day it just disappeared. So then he kept listening and listening to see if anybody had heard anything. So he just kind of sat there not knowing whatever happened to the barrel. And it was only as part of a plea bargain that he admitted to killing this guy. And then, okay, so I will give him credit. He was very creative and like, I mean, so his gun jammed and he found something right there to take care of business.
That's so cold, man. That is really cold.
It is. Like, he doesn't fuck around. Mm-hmm. So then his next victim was, this fellow's last name was Smith. And Smith was kind of laying low due to recent arrests of their gang members. So Kuklinski said, like, just go lay low. So he went to a hotel. But Kuklinski didn't feel like he could be trusted and that he was a risk. So Kuklinski laced his hamburger with cyanide.
Oh.
Yeah. But it wasn't acting as quickly as Kuklinski had hoped. So he was in the hotel room with the guy, and he grabs a lamp and just strangles him to death with the cord on the lamp. Again, very resourceful. But this is where he started getting really sloppy, because his dumbass would have gotten away with it if he hadn't strangled him. The ligature marks were the key that led to police to determine that this was, in fact, a homicide. So not only is this whole thing going sideways, he is waiting for his getaway driver, Brenda Deppner. She never shows up.
Oh, a woman getaway driver.
Yep.
Okay.
So now he's stuck in the hotel and has no way to move this body. So his buddy, Mr. Deppner, he and Kuklinski placed Smith's body between the mattress and the box spring in the hotel room.
Ew.
So the body was there until somebody, they started complaining because it smelled. Not just the people in the room, but like globally. So four people would have stayed in that room.
Oh my God, and they slept on this dead body?
Yep.
Oh my God.
And again,
something to think about the next time I go on vacation.
Because this isn't the first story that I've heard about people doing that. I always check when I'm checking for bed bugs at a hotel. I lift up the mattress to make sure there's nobody underneath of it. But yeah, so I'm like, wow, four guests. So I don't know how many days that was.
But how did they stand the smell?
And I mean, this was December though, too. So it was cold.
Well, that probably helped it, but God, anybody that's ever smelled death before, it's a very distinctive smell.
Oh, yeah. And, like, the deeper into the stages you get, the worse it smells. So yeah, four people had stayed in the room, and then basically the surrounding rooms were starting to complain. And I'm like, did they not change the sheets? Like, how do you miss that? I don't know. But that's what happened. So then our buddy Deppner, who helped hide this body, he was moved to a nice apartment in Bergenfield, New Jersey. The owner was out of town. And Kuklinski had the keys to the apartment while he was out of town. But between February and May of 1983, so this was like 6 months after the fact, Kuklinski had killed Deppner. The owner of the apartment helped Kuklinski move the body after telling him that his friend was in trouble and needed to avoid the police. So why would you go along with this? Just dumb. So they wrapped the body in green garbage bags and they dumped his corpse approximately like 3 miles away from where Kuklinski and his family used to go horseback riding. So on May 14th, 1983. So this guy was killed between February and May. After a bicyclist had spotted a body that was surrounded by vultures.
Okay.
So, you know, automatically, like, all right, well, investigators show up and they're like, we have no idea how this guy died. He's in a green garbage bag. So aside from the vulture damage, they had noticed that he had pink spots on his skin. And he also had what appeared to be ligature marks.
Oh, see, if he didn't choke him, they probably would have thought not much of it.
Right.
Although he was in the garbage bag, so.
Right. And the pink spots are indicative of cyanide.
Uh-oh. I did not know that.
So here they have this big guy. He has no defense wounds on him. Which struck them as weird. Like, how does a healthy, grown man not put up a fight? So that was clue one. But then they, you know, they're going along with the autopsy. And they discover his stomach is full of undigested food. Which means he died right after or during his last meal.
Oh, so then it kind of narrows it down. And that's where the hamburger came in.
Right. So he basically did to him what he did to Smith. So he probably poisoned him, it wasn't as quick as he wanted, and then he strangled him. It's like, dude, stop. They're going to die. It's cyanide. There's no,
exactly. Calm down.
Yeah, there's no antidote.
You get your way.
Yeah, just let it go. He talked about in these documentaries how he would, put cyanide in a drink and then just, accidentally bump into people in a bar and wait for it to, soak into their clothes and then go through their skin and let it happen.
I didn't realize it was that strong.
That's what scared me. I was like, holy shit. I didn't realize. I mean, I knew if it got through your pores and stuff like that, but I didn't know. Like, you would think that your clothing would be some kind of
protection.
But yeah, so he would talk about, just putting cyanide. Cyanide was one of his favorite tools, actually. But, I mean, apparently it wasn't that great because that's where he kept fucking up. That's twice. Now he's got two bodies that have clues of cyanide and strangle marks. It's like, now you're starting to get an MO.
Oh, yeah.
So then later on in 83, on September 25th, the body of Louis Masque was discovered in Orangetown, New York, with a bullet hole in the back of his head. The funny thing about this is that he went missing approximately July 1st, 1980.
Wow, that's a long time difference.
Yeah, so he was supposed to have met Kuklinski at a diner, and he was going to buy blank videotapes off of him so that he could do the porno ring. So Kuklinski shot him in the head and then put him in a freezer for about 15 months.
Oh my, why did he hold on to him?
We don't know. So because he was getting sloppy, though, he didn't let the body thaw before he dumped it. He just wrapped it in plastic garbage bags again. And that actually helped keep it partially frozen. And once the ME was actually going in and doing the autopsy, once they found the body, they're like, hey, there's ice crystals in this dude. And it's September. He shouldn't be this cold. You know what I mean? If you just found, how cold it's been up here, it's like, you'd expect somebody to have ice crystals if they've been dead for a while. But
yeah, so if he had just at least let him thaw, they probably wouldn't have had so much information.
Well, that's the thing. I'm like, okay, so these are associates of yours and things like that. Like, why are you not hiding them in better places? And like I said, he was getting sloppy. Mm. So I don't know. So this is how they got the moniker Iceman.
Okay.
Yeah, you put them in a freezer. Yeah. So I think that makes sense. But we got to stop giving them names like this.
That's a cool name.
It is a cool name, but we got to call him dumbass who doesn't thaw man. Criminal. You know what I mean? We got to give them
You were reaching, you just never really grabbed it.
I know. But what else would we call him? Don't call him the Iceman. That sounds way too cool. Oh, God. Idiot who forgot to take dinner out, man. So, and he doesn't have an Instapot big enough to defrost that.
No, nobody wants to reuse that Instapot.
Oh, hell no. Not even those garbage bags. No. I like to reuse and recycle, but no thank you.
Yeah.
So that's how he got his name. Because he put this poor bastard in a freezer for almost a year and a half. So then we come to Millibrand. He was all killed on January 30th, 1980. So these guys were all kind of all over the place. Just because this is when they started connecting him with particular robberies and things like that. So this guy again was supposed to sell him tapes. Kuklinski kills him, puts him in a drum, and left him near the Chemitex chemical plant. He had to cut his tendons to be able to put his body in the drum.
Ugh.
And a week later, February 5th, the body was discovered. And ultimately, as part of a plea deal, Kuklinski admitted that he shot him 5 times, saying that it was due to business.
Due to business.
You know.
Wow. He's He's a tough businessman.
And so I'm like, oof, what did he do to piss you off?
Really?
So let's go back and talk about this undercover investigation. This dude, Pola Ferone, became fast friends with Kuklinski. And Pola Ferone would record conversations that he would have with Kuklinski. And in one of the conversations, they discussed how he kept a body in a freezer for 2.5 years.
That's awful.
First off, where do you have this freezer? That's got to be a big freezer.
It's got to be. You can't, and you can't put your own stuff in it.
Right.
There's a body in there. That's just
wrong.
Bad manners.
Well, I'm sure he, maybe it was a tax write-off.
Maybe.
So he eventually asked Pola Ferone if he could buy some pure cyanide from him. He had talked about getting it so he could tie up some loose ends, and he wanted to hit this wealthy Jewish cocaine dealer. He also wanted to tie up the loose ends of the bitch that never came with the car, which led to the hotel thing.
Oh.
So he had his reasons.
Okay. So she's going to get hers too.
Well, she becomes, she's good for the court.
Okay.
So the capture, on December 17th of 1986, he was arrested at a roadblock. Prior to his arrest, he had met with Pola Ferone to get the cyanide. And Kuklinski was like, no, I'm going to test this first. So he found a stray dog and he put the substance in hamburger. The dog ate it and didn't die.
Oh, okay.
So he was like, no, I'm just going to go home. This doesn't seem right. I'm just going to go home. So he went home and he was faced with a roadblock.
Oh.
So even his wife was charged with disorderly conduct because she was interfering with his arrest. And there was a firearm discovered in the car. So she was also charged with possession of a firearm because she was a passenger in the car. Oh. Before this, like, she had zero clue of what was going on.
She had no clue.
No clue.
Killing people left and right.
And he even left. So one of the stories he would tell is that it was Christmas Eve and this guy owed him money. So he left the family festivities, went and took care of business, took care of the guy, told him he needed his money, went back home. Everybody's in bed. He goes back out to find this guy again. The guy still doesn't have his money and he kills him. Goes back home and there for Christmas morning.
Ooh.
Yeah. So he's not messing around.
No.
So eventually he took several plea deals, which meant that he did confess to the five murders we talked about. He was charged with the five counts of murder, six weapon charges, attempted murder, robbery, and attempted robbery. So in March 1988, he was found guilty of Smith and Deppner's murders. This meant that the death penalty was taken off, so he at least faced the minimum of 60 years. But he did plead guilty to killing Maskey and Malibrand, which gave him two additional life sentences. And also as part of the plea deal, this would drop the charges for his wife, and also his son had like a weed possession charge, so that was dropped as well.
Okay.
So I'm like, well, you know, at least he kept his family out of it. But yeah, he wouldn't have been eligible for parole until he was 111 years old.
He didn't go anyplace.
No. So about 18 years into his jail sentence, he was diagnosed with Kawasaki disease. It's kind of, it's that inflammation. You know how they keep talking about that inflammatory illness that kids get after COVID?
Yeah.
It's basically that, but an adult.
Oh, okay.
So he was in and out of the hospitals and things like that. And his wife ultimately signed a DNR, even though Kuklinski said, no, I want you to do everything. So they called his wife and she was like, nope, we're going to honor the DNR. And they just didn't revive him. So he had served 19 years in prison before he died.
So he, let me get this straight. He wanted people to make every effort to keep him alive.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that ironic?
Right? And meanwhile, I'm like, if I'm in prison, and that's not a fun disease. Like, all of your, basically, like, your blood vessels are inflamed and things like that. That can't be comfortable. And then it, like, caused heart problems and, like, I don't know. So, before his death, he claimed that he killed over 100 people. Some detectives have followed up on all of these people he so-called murdered and don't believe him. But he did talk about this one from the guy drove the Mr. Softy ice cream truck, Rob Prongay. He says he shot him because he was a loudmouth. Roy DeMeo, who introduced him to the crime family. He also confessed to killing a NYPD officer, Peter Calabro.
Oh, that's not good.
And he also said that he was responsible for killing Jimmy Hoffa.
Did they ever prove that?
No, he said that four of them had kidnapped him and he was the one that offed Jimmy.
Huh.
But he didn't put him through the wood chipper.
That's a whole nother story.
I know. So, here's my question. I know he was like a murder for hire and stuff, but the great debate is he a serial killer?
Well, he admitted to killing four people at first, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, no, it wasn't four, it was 100.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think to me, a serial killer is somebody that is killing because they get a pleasure out of it, not because of a circumstance.
He was getting 5 to 6 figures per murder.
Okay, so he was getting paid to kill people.
Right.
Or he killed them because they had a big mouth and they annoyed him.
Right.
To me, a serial killer is not getting paid for it. It's just, they just do it basically for the notoriety. Even if they don't know who it is, he still feels like he's empowered. This guy's like doing it and doesn't want anybody to know he's doing it.
But then again, he like hid them in spots where people would find them. Some of them. Because if he killed over 100 people and they say that they couldn't like connect him to all 100 of them, then that's kind of him just blowing steam. But he also used so many different methods to kill. Like at one point he was talking about using a crossbow, obviously the lamp cords, ice picks, bombs, firearms, grenades, and his favorite was the cyanide.
Yeah, so see, he used all different forms of killing.
Right, and he did use the tire iron too at that one time.
That's rough. You know, Cal, it's one thing to kill somebody, but that's got to be like the worst.
At least, hopefully, he got knocked out on the first ringer.
I never want to be mutilated like that. I don't want to be killed. Let's just say that.
Right.
But I would think it would be a lot less painful if you were shot than to be beat to death with a tire iron.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why I'm hoping that he, the first blow to the head kind of knocked him out.
One would hope. It's rough.
So, yeah, that is the story of Richard Kuklinski. And when you watch his, the interviews that they did on HBO, like, sometimes he'll get teary-eyed, but for, like, the most part, they'd be like, well, how did you feel about that? And he's like, I don't know, I just didn't feel. And when he wasn't out doing jobs, he was home. He was a homebody. He liked hanging out with his family. And
I would like to know, was he, did he have a great home life? Or is it just something that people perceived him? Like, out in public, he was a great family man, but was he like that behind closed doors?
Right, because his wife didn't have too much to say. She was like, he was always there for the kids. But then I was also reading that there were reports that, just like most of these, it's keeping up with the Joneses. It's happy, or, like your Facebook people that are like, oh, I'm so in love. And then meanwhile, it's like they're in the middle of a
really awful.
Yeah. So that we'll probably never know because his wife hasn't come out. And
is she still alive?
Yep.
Interesting. Well, his nickname is fitting.
It is, but we gotta stop giving him cool nicknames.
Yeah, but it's not just because he put people in the freezer. He was cold.
He was pretty cold. So
it was fitting both ways, I guess.
That's true.
Well, thanks for that, Kelly.
Yeah, I know we've been talking about him for a while now, so I was like, I'm going to just dive in.
That was really good.
So, and then next week, you have a special.
I do. I have a special co-host, John Mudgett, John H. Mudgett, rather. He's the guy that wrote the book Crazy Is As Crazy Does, The Life Ooh. Of a Serial Killer.
That's right. I love that book. He's going to write a sequel.
I don't know if he is. I keep trying to, talk him into that, but we're going to talk about one of his characters in his book, and I don't want to give it away.
Oh, okay.
But it was the character Jim, or Jimmy.
Oh, right, because we had some theories about who that was.
Yeah, we did. So we're going to get to the bottom of that.
Okay. I can't wait to hear it. But in the meantime, everybody behave themselves. We'll try our best.
Well, I'm not making any promises.
That's why I said we're going to do our best, because isn't trying to be good just as important as being good?
You listen to what I said, Kelly.
I do.
Yes, it is.
So I'm going to try.
So everybody try, and we'll catch you later.
Bye.
Find us at patreon.com/shinythingspodcast. Follow us on Instagram at shinythingspodcast. Find us on our Facebook group page called Shiny Things Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at shinythingspod1. You can email us at shinythingspodcast@gmail.com. Don't be shy. Use any of our social media to send us show ideas, some love, or share additional details we may have missed. Remember to like us and give us 5 stars on your favorite podcasting platform. Until next time, thanks for listening.
This show is a part of the Quite the Thing Media Podcast Network.